This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 17th of April, 2012, on Monocle 24. Section D, in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. The global design industry is currently tramping the streets of Milan for the 51st Salone del Mobile, but last week there was another event in another city that caused a stir. Chicago is home to some of America's most impressive architecture, so it's fitting that it also hosts the Architecture and Design Film Festival. Now in its third year, it's the largest event of its kind, showcasing 31 films from 13 countries, alongside a series of panel discussions and events celebrating architecture and design on the big screen. We headed to the Windy City to see more for ourselves. Coming up over the next hour, we sit down with architect and director Jord Den Hollander to talk about his new film Mission Statements, which looks at the rocky road of embassy architecture.
Of course, that would be wonderful if you could build an embassy without all these security gates, but I don't think in this world it will ever happen. And that's a sad story, of course.
A report on Chicago's impressive architectural heritage.
Chicago is no longer the broad-shouldered city that stacks wheat and makes steel, as writer Carl Sandburg romanticized a century ago in his poem Chicago. But when Sandburg writes the city is planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, now that remains true.
And we deliver an overview of all the sights, sounds, and spectacular cinematic showcases from the festival.
There'll be half a dozen people talking about something creative, and at some points it'll intersect with architecture, and at some points it'll intersect with film, and at some points it'll intersect with who the heck knows what.
Away from Chicago, we also sit down in the studio of one of our favourite Brazilian architects, Marcio Kogan, and we head to Berlin to catch up with the wunderkind of the German scene, Jürgen Meyer-Ha. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D, so dig out your hard hat and stay tuned. The Architecture and Design Film Festival has, in a short space of time, lodged itself in the diaries of industry pundits and enthusiasts. The organisers put together a curated programme designed to spark new ideas around design and the built environment, combined with talks, events and, of course, films. It's a travelling circus, starting first in New York City, it then heads to Chicago, and next year organisers are hoping to add Los Angeles to the circuit too. We sent our reporter, Andrew Gill, to get the lowdown on the high-rises, and here's what he found.
The Music Box Theater on Chicago's north side is the city's favorite remaining movie palace. Built 15 years after nearby Wrigley Field, the theater is a throwback to the days when designers tried to recreate Italian scenes indoors. Last weekend, the Architecture and Design Film Festival took over the theater, tweaking the space with chic couches and a temporary lounge erected in the alley. It's the second year of the festival in Chicago. Festival founder Kyle Bergman says that the space the festival happens in is important.
I ran a test of the festival in a small town in Vermont. It was a small theater that had two theaters and a bar and a restaurant and cafe. And it was always this idea that the festival needed to be more than just showing films, but the interesting things happened in between the films where people get a chance to talk to each other and get a chance to explore ideas. This small town in Vermont had the perfect theater to do the test run. We did it up there in September in 2009, and we had over 1,000 people come from all over New England and, you know, was able to really see what worked and what didn't.
After that successful test, Bergman next mounted the festival in his hometown of New York.
Since I'm from New York, it was easier to start it there. But one of the obvious places to do it is Chicago, with just this amazing interest in architecture and design. You have things like the Chicago Architectural Foundation, which you don't have in any other city.
That general interest in design is part of the festival's DNA.
Showing films actually kind of levels the playing field for discussion afterward. If I saw a film on baseball, and then I was talking with some professional baseball people and non-professional, there's a place, a starting point of a conversation. And so the same thing with the film festival. It allows everyone, like we show a film called Unfinished Spaces about this amazing story in Cuba. It has a human story as well as an architecture story. And you come out of that film And everyone then can understand and be able to talk about it from there. So really, it's a great place to begin dialogue about design.
Unfinished Spaces opened the festival with the moving story of Cuba's national art schools and the architects who are still trying to finish the buildings they began 50 years ago.
If you want to stay, we're going to do a little Q&A, and we're fortunate to have Ben Murray, the director of the film here. Ben, come on up. Ben.
I've never heard about this thing in Cuba before. It's actually quite amazing. And the fact that it's still standing, despite the neglect, totally amazed me.
That's Frank Cavanaugh, Chicago architect, just after watching Unfinished Spaces.
And it's like most architects. It's like, you know, you have a project and then you don't have a project. It's touch and go. But the vision of this thing was quite incredible. It's more in comparison with some of the, say, the grand projects that the French government took in the 1980s. I never heard of it. Maybe I'm just ignorant, but I don't think anybody else heard of it either.
To help foster the exchange of ideas, the festival includes several free panel discussions and something called Pachakacha.
Pachakacha gives somebody who's passionate about a subject 20 times 20 seconds, 400 seconds. They show 20 slides, 20 images on the screen, and talk about each one for 20 seconds.
That's Peter Exley, an architect and the impresario behind Chicago's version of the event that began in Tokyo.
Pachakacha, chit-chat, is the antidote to the lecture. When you give an architect a lecture, it's a very monotone and endless event.
You can't say pachakacha. Imagine that you're green and Jim Henson has his hand up your ass. Pachakacha. Da-da-da-da-da. Pachakacha. This is audience participation time.
There'll be half a dozen people talking about something creative, and at some points it'll intersect with architecture, and at some points it'll intersect with film, and at some points it'll intersect with who the heck knows what.
Let's have a big hand for Tyler, and thank you, because he did this at very short notice, and he was working at the film fest. You can catch him all weekend. Tyler.
All right, so we do some pretty weird work, and this is 8 years ago in El Salvador. We started flying to El Salvador and building...
Tyler Kobik is a design builder who volunteers for the festival. He shares slides that follow his career from building clinics and schools in Central America to whimsical structures for Patch Adams, Bonnaroo, and Fish.
Nowadays, I live half the time in Burlington, half the time in Hillsboro, West Virginia, which is a town of 200 people. No code enforcement in this area, by the way. You can do whatever you want. This is the least populated county east of Mississippi.
After his talk, I asked what connects architecture and film for him.
I find music to be integral to any experience of architecture. I mean, the power and the ability for filmmakers to work over the choreography of the music with the filmmaking, I think, really imbues space with different interesting sort of insights that I don't necessarily normally get when I experience something in an architectural real-life circumstance. There's such a paradox and a link between the two that I don't know how you disconnect one from the other. You know, really, Louis Kahn said that architecture is frozen music, and I very much feel that as I experience the world.
Music is central to a few of the films in the festival. There's Architect, a chamber opera in six scenes, a film inspired by the life of Lou Kahn. Also,
one of the films in the festival is Pool Party. And it was made by a director from Williamsburg who was very much interested in the indie music scene in Williamsburg. And so she made a film about McCarran Pool, which was all these concerts happened. But the pool was designed by Robert Moses, and there's this whole architecture and urbanism part to the festival. And when we contacted her and said, we'd like you to be in an architecture film festival, she's like, wow, that's cool. Because, you know, she was really thinking of it as a film about independent music.
McCarran Pool is one of the biggest public pools in the world. And it is closed, and it's got to be open.
I'm from the South, the Bay, man, for the living in the country with the good and the bad. It's a shame on America.
One film may seem to have a connection to music through Bjork's latest release, but Biophilic Design is really a moral manifesto. Here's the film's director, Bill Finnegan.
Biophilic Design, The Architecture of Life, is about architecture that connects people in nature. And it's a different way of looking at green architecture, where the focus tends to be on the performance of a building in terms of energy or the impact on the environment in terms of pollution or materials. And with biophilic design, it's really focused on the human experience of the built environment.
Falling water, the irony is, it's built right into a stream course. You couldn't possibly do that today. It uses far more materials and consumes far more materials than you would want. And yet the structure oozes a positive and affirmative and aesthetically compelling relationship between people and nature.
The festival paired biophilic design with a short film called Minka.
Our film is very information-driven, and we kind of are making a case, so we kind of bounce around a lot and show you lots of examples so that you hopefully can come away from the film understanding what we meant as an approach to architecture, whereas Minka is a beautifully shot film about a farmhouse in Japan that you can intellectually appreciate through biophilic design. So a lot of the ideas that we try to explain can help you understand why that is an appealing space. But that film is all about quiet moments and things left unsaid and relationships between people and between people and place. That complement, I think, shows that you can have films talking to the same ideas but have completely different approaches to it.
Festival director Kyle Bergman says no matter the type of film, the festival has one specific goal.
Really, the festival is about upping the design dialogue, and film is just really a great way to do it.
That was our reporter Andrew Gill taking in the fun and games on offer at the 3rd Chicago Design and Architecture Film Festival. One film in particular piqued our interest. Mission Statements is by Jord den Hollander, Dutch architect, director, and curator of the Rotterdam Architecture Biennale. It tells the story of four very different new Dutch embassies in Paramaribo, Maputo, Berlin, and Addis Ababa. It shows the background of the buildings and presents a stunning view behind the curtains of daily life in each embassy. Did the architecture really add to the diplomacy the Netherlands stood for? Mission Statements unveils the underestimated cultural aspect in international diplomacy and the misunderstanding that comes with it. Our reporter, Alison Cuddy, sat down with Den Hollander to hear more.
Governments use architecture in many different ways. You know, you think of our capital buildings as a way to represent power, or even our memorials to talk about our history and our values. Missions are fascinating because they're really at the center of what diplomacy looks like around the world. Let's talk about the four embassies that you chose and how they represent Dutch power.
Yeah, they're really icons. And as an architect, you always start with the site and the program. But here's another layer, the layer of representation, who we are. How can you tell it in a building, in architecture? And that's fascinating. If you look at architecture in that way, a whole new story occurs. And therefore, I selected these four out of a program. Since 1991, there were 25 new embassies built, but these four are the most outspoken.
These embassies are huge. I mean, they're beautiful, but they could practically be museums. They have these massive wall-sized doors. Some of them are, you know, several feet deep.
Yeah.
You know, what are the stories of Dutch power and Dutch identity that they represent in
these
buildings?
Well, in the end, I couldn't find out, because normally you would say, well, what is Dutch identity? That's cheese, that's tulips, the tulips that are sometimes planted here in the parks in Chicago as well. Mm-hmm. It's windmills, it's wooden shoes, it's smoking weed or pot in Amsterdam. It's a very liberal attitude, but that's not a thing you can put in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised in the end when we did all this filming all around the world that the architects really adapt to the other country. And if one thing is clear after this, one could say, investigation, the adaptation of another culture into your own culture can be seen in all that architecture.
I want to talk about a scene in Mozambique. One of the architects is there outside the embassy, and he talks about how they negotiated this deal with the school next door, that they needed to tear down a wall. So they, in turn, built a basketball court for the school. And the architect points to the basketball court and then also to this opening in the embassy as a way of how they've sort of successfully integrated the embassy into the community around them.
So when we're in the embassy, we can hear the kids, we can hear the balls being played with. So it's a wonderful compromise. It's a wonderful way that the embassy interacts with the school and with the children.
But your footage suggests something other than that, that actually there's not much interaction going on between the citizens of that community and the embassy.
Sometimes it turns out, when an architect said, well, this building is open to the public, and then when you arrive there, the doors are closed and you have to ring a bell and et cetera, et cetera. So the reality is often more harsh than the dreams of the architect.
Do you think that fact that some people are not going to be able to come inside, or they control who comes inside, is that just the reality of the security profile that a mission has to take into consideration?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, I'm thinking of the American embassies that were built in the 50s and the 60s when America tried to expose their idea of democracy to the world, and of course their idea of power in the world. And in those days, embassies were very open and they were kind of public spaces. So you could expose the interior and tell the people with the interior where you stand in the world. And that's of course, a negative thing, that you build something, say, in a very poor country, and people who live around, they only see the exposure from the outside, and they say, well, they can afford because they're rich. And now we are confronted with their richness. So only the ones who are lucky to be invited by the ambassador or whoever can see what's inside.
You actually got to go inside, and that's one of the amazing things about the film, that you get to go inside these spaces that normally most of us would not be able to go inside. What did you make of what was happening in there? What surprised you?
Well, the funny thing is that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was very open to our approach, and they said, well, we give you permission of doing anything. And with that in mind, I had this idea to ask the ambassadors, who are not architects, to guide architects around. So,
yeah, talk about a scene. One of my favorite people in the film, actually, is, I think he's the deputy ambassador in Berlin. He gives you a tour of the building.
He showed, literally, after all the prizes that building has won in Germany and in the world, and the architecture was praised by everybody. And then suddenly you see the other side of the coin, the side of the users, that they don't like the building and it's very hard to work in. Well, it's a story about the user and the architects as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Some of them, as you say, are leaving, and one of them says, we're going to go live in a normal house now, right? Yeah. Where's your point of view? Because you bring the point of view of the people living inside, you bring the point of view of the architects who designed these buildings, and you bring the point of view of the people who live around them, not in, but outside of them. Where do you rest in all those points of view?
Well, first of all, I'm very positive about the idea that a government uses culture for an international dialogue. I mean, that's the best thing you can do. You don't talk about guns or making use of someone's country or religion or political attitudes. No, it's about culture. And therefore, I'm, in that sense, the whole program, I'm very positive about it. And if someone says, well, it's not my kind of art, then it's still art.
I'm curious, as an architect yourself, you've done some really fun projects, like a pop-up library inside a shipping container. And I wonder what you would do with an embassy.
Well, I would tell a story that would make people laugh, and therefore make a friendly building, and maybe a building that has more humor in it.
Do you think it's possible to create an embassy that doesn't have to contend with security issues, that can get away with not having gates and barriers and plexiglass and, you know, space age doorways, so that you keep people out or keep threats out?
Well, that's the most important question you can ask. Could there be a world without war or without fighting? Of course, that would be wonderful if you could build an embassy without all these security gates. But I don't think in this world it will ever happen. And that's a sad story, of course.
That was Alison Cuddy with architect and director Jord Den Hollander in Chicago. Time for a short break, but stay with us. We've an ode to Chicago's architecture scene coming up after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Lee Bay was architecture critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He worked as a mayoral deputy chief of staff for Richard M. Daley before that. And previously, he served as director of governmental affairs for the Chicago office of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. Today, he's executive director of the Chicago Central Area Committee. And with such a strong pedigree working in the city's built environment, we tasked him to take us through the architectural heritage of Chicago.
Chicago is no longer the broad-shouldered city that stacks wheat and makes steel, as writer Carl Sandburg romanticized a century ago in his poem Chicago. But when Sandburg writes the city is planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, now that remains true. Chicago builds. As a result, its famous skyline is in constant change. Perhaps more than any other American city, Chicago's image and self-worth are embodied in its architecture. The city renews itself and advances its stature through that architecture. It's been that way since 1893. That's when Chicago introduced itself to the surprised world with the beautiful neoclassical buildings of the 1893 World's Fair. It's an ethos that gave the city and the world the former Sears Tower, a brawny, swaggering 1,400-foot-tall skyscraper that was once the tallest building on the planet. And it continues today with efforts such as downtown's Millennium Park, which still garners world notice after opening in 2004. The active contemporary park has high-quality public art by Anish Kapoor and others, and there are fountains, an amphitheater, an ice skating rink, and more, all of which built over the unsightly sunken tracks of a commuter rail line. The city continues to change, and architecture showcases that change. Chicago has seen the rise of the residential skyscraper, such as Trump Tower. Built in 2008, the 1,389-foot tower is the city's second tallest building. Chicago's latest design sensation is Aqua Tower, an 86-story mixed-use high-rise that has won acclaim locally and internationally due to its curved balconies and a sustainable program of rainwater collection, energy conservation, and a green roof. Even architect Santiago Calatrava's twisting 2,000-foot-tall Chicago spire, which failed to be built due to the economic collapse of 2008, is still a minor point of pride here. It shows the city can still lure architects from around the world who want to build big. Indeed, many of the world's best architects have done work here in recent years. Rem Koolhaas, Frank Gehry, Renzo Piano. Their work adds to a canon that includes Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, and other architectural luminaries. Sir Norman Foster and Zaha Hadid want to build here, each submitted a proposal recently to redesign the city's tourist-friendly Navy Pier on Lake Michigan. Neither one was picked, but audiences packed an auditorium to see and discuss the work of the finalists who were picked. Architecture matters that much in Chicago, and the subject can be debated as hotly as the sports teams here. And certainly Carl Sandburg would have approved.
That was Lee Bay, Executive Director of the Chicago Central Area Committee. Before we leave the city, there's time for a song. And from one man with a love for the city to another, this is American folk singer Sufjan Stevens with his ode. This is Chicago. That was Sufjan Stevens with Chicago. You're listening to Section D. Time to leave the Windy City and head to warmer climes south of the equator. Think Brazilian architecture, and you likely think of the hulking poetic concrete structures from the modernist era, which peaked in the 1950s and 60s. These modernist designs have been making a comeback in recent years, though. Studio MK27, an architecture firm started by Marcio Kogan in the 1980s, is one of Brazil's design studios that today practices a softer style, with roots in the concrete heritage of his forebears. Kogan is one of the most sought-after architects working within Brazil and increasingly abroad. He tells Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter everything from how his work is influenced by the Brazilian modernist movement to what he ate for lunch.
I'm Marcio Kogan, an architect from Brazil, born and raised in São Paulo, and will probably die here. I wear glasses. I just finished to eat a very good feijoada here in São Paulo. And behind my work, I'm a kind of prostitute. Clients pay me for pleasure and satisfaction.
The journey behind Marcio's idea and work begins here at his Jardim Paulista-based studio in São Paulo. We take a peek into his spec rooms, looking at the bits and pieces of his architectural designs. Like hidden portals, these hingeless doors seemingly blend in with the studio's white walls. But when opened, they uncovered handmade tiles, countertops, and other bits and bobs of projects he's designed over the years. Marcio regularly comes into these walk-in closets full of samples for inspiration. But it wasn't always Marcio's dream to become an architect. His moment of realization came while skipping school as a teenager.
When I was around 15 or 16 years old, I was cutting class from the public school that I studied in São Paulo. It began to rain. I entered the first place as possible that was a movie theater. I sat down to see the film, and I had a kind of a very important moment in my life. I saw the film was The Silence, by Ingmar Bergman. In that moment, I learned for the first time the importance of art in the life. During a lot of time, I didn't know if I would be an architect or a filmmaker. I directed 13 short films and one feature film. Maybe more recently, in the last 10 years, I learned all the importance of the modernism in Brazil that began in the end of the 30s until in the highest point in the inauguration of Brasilia in 1960.
Characterized by straight lines and stark contrasts in color, Brazil's modernist movement is evident in Marcio's work, who came to see the movement as a true inspiration.
For me, it's incredible how such a country like Brazil in the 40s or 50s that's completely disconnected with the First World produced so good architecture, not only Oscar Niemeyer, but maybe 10, 12 very, very good architects. This is a little bit magic, very important for our office, this story, is that in Brazil, they didn't have some tradition to follow. It's a new country, and the architects felt better to create a new movement.
We go up to the top two floors of Marcio's MK27 three-floor studio, which started off as a solo project, but has now grown into a team of 20 architects.
And now we try just to hire people that they are very creative. We're not very concerned with the production of the office, which means that the office think well, but don't produce well. I'm very, very critic with myself. I never say, no, wow, fantastic. All the time I only see problems and how to do it better. And it means the latest projects or the brand new ones I prefer.
But even though Marcio jokes that MK27 doesn't produce well, its bold creativity certainly has got some attention. The studio has won several awards, including the Leaf Award in 2009, for a beach house that's only accessible by boat in the historic town of Paraty in Rio de Janeiro State. The same project was awarded Best Private House at the 2010 Design Awards. He tells about one of his latest projects which MK27 was selected to design. An interior upgrade while keeping the old facade on a row of buildings on Rio de Janeiro's waterfront.
One project that's very, very interesting for us that we're doing now in Rio de Janeiro. It's a kind of center of production and School of Theater related with Municipal, Teatro Municipal do Rio de Janeiro, the Rio de Janeiro Municipal Theater. It's a fantastic place, very, very important. It's a joint venture with the Alla Scala, Teatro Alla Scala of Milano, that's also fantastic. This is a place that they produce all things for the operas, the settings of the Municipal, and also they have a school to graduate technicians in the area of theater, movie, TV. One thing that's very good, it's completely free. It's also for poor people.
And he shows a few more interesting projects.
We're doing also a Eco Villa near São Paulo, extreme Eco Villa. They want a very, very extreme project, sustainable, 100%. And now, this week, we began doing a project in Bali. It's a hotel and beach club.
This is very interesting drawing.
Where is this one?
Yeah. And with a few clicks of a mouse, we're taken all over the world as blueprints of various MK27 projects flash across several computer screens. From a house being built under the scorching sun of New Delhi to a modernist-infused ski chalet being constructed in the knee-deep snow of Whistler, Canada. But how his studio's designs caught the attention of literally the whole world is still a mystery to Marcio.
Really, really, I don't know. And doing a project in New Delhi is completely... I probably would never be in there if I didn't get this project, but it's very interesting.
As part of a new breed of architects pulling influence from the Brazilian modernist movement, Marcio Kogan's Sao Paulo MK27 studio is breathing new life into a revival of an old movement. Only that this time, the Brazilian architectural influences are reaching well beyond the country's borders. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Time for a quick break, but stick around. We're off to Berlin after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Berlin-based architect Jürgen Meyer-Ha is part of a forward-thinking, dynamic young generation of architects. Projects like the Metropole Parasol, a wooden outdoor structure that revitalized a public square in the old city of Seville, Spain, or his many municipal buildings throughout the country of Georgia, which look a bit like futuristic sculptures, have cemented his reputation. Until now, though, Meyer-Ha had never built anything in his hometown of Berlin. On Johannesstrasse, in Berlin-Mitte, his first project is officially complete. It's a 25-unit residential building with a striking facade clad in wavy, fin-like forms. It's a major departure from Berlin's usually conventional and overly cautious approach to residential architect. We sent our Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, to quiz Meyer-Ha over the new landmark and hear more about his unusual career.
The apartment building Johannesstrasse 3 is an important project for us because it brings our architectural ideas that we developed in so many projects all over Europe by now into the heart of Berlin. It is a comment on how current and contemporary architecture can be an important contribution to the urban diversity, the fabric of the city, which is, of course, a city very much based on the fragments that we created in the 20th century. And it also wants to be a part that shows that individual voices can create multiplicity in a city rather than trying to unify everything, which is happening usually in this very sentimental approach that architects do here in the city.
You told me before that you've been a bit criticized by Berlin-based architects or German architects. Can you tell me why? And also tell me about their response to this particular project.
German architectural discussion usually still is very much anchored in a post-war understanding of appropriateness and responding to its neighbors and trying to be kind of more of a service rather than an aesthetic or a cultural endeavor or adventure. I see architecture as something that has to catch its moment, that has to witness our time, and therefore becomes kind of timeless because it is proving where it was at that time of its creation. Of course, it's also only a work that happens in a collaboration between a client, between the architect and the city. So it's something that only works in a certain accomplice situation. Architecture in Berlin is mostly based on this sentimental idea of repairing what was lost in the 20th century. But it's even more rewarding to hear that the critique now or the comments on the building are very, very positive and actually quite supporting to add something new to the, or add a new layer to what was happening so far in architecture in Berlin.
What makes it look so different?
The building tries to bring the understanding of a green courtyard over terraces and balconies into the interior, also into sunken living room areas, for example. So there's a very landscape idea about the building. You can also see that softness, that elasticity, this kind of wavy surface being the facade, or like also like reappearing at the facade. And this covers the building in the front as much as in the backyard. It's also important to see that the building really wants to be very transparent and very light. From the inside, you have all glass facades. You can always look out. From the outside, these lamellas that you see are creating privacy and discretion. So it actually plays with being open, being discreet, being exposed, being kind of hidden. And this ambivalence makes the special atmosphere of the building.
You recently gained a lot of accolades with your big public project in Seville in Spain, Metropol Parasol. Can you tell me how your career has changed since then?
Metropol Parasol really put us on the map globally. It is a very unique project which might only happen once in a lifetime. We are building on Roman ruins. We are building the very heart of a medieval city, an architecture that is so from now or even from tomorrow. It is everyday project, you know, with market halls and, you know, for neighborhood uses, as much as it is a tourist destination. It is an indicator for its innovation capacity of Sevilla. And it combines highest technologies in construction with a very kind of atmospheric space. Politically, it was important to become kind of the center for the revolution. It was the main activity point for gay pride. It is kind of the hotspot for the Semana Santa, the, you know, Catholic processions. You have commercial uses as much as cultural institutions being there. So it's kind of the prototype for a new understanding of urban space, for like a social gathering space, for a community. And I think a city cannot make a better gift to its citizens than building something like this.
And are you getting more public space commissions because of this?
Yes, since we won the competition in 2004, we got approached for many, many projects, even now that it's finished, and you see how well it works as an activator for urban space. We also get invited to do a lot of studies and other projects. But mainly our projects in Georgia, which are a lot of infrastructural projects, happened through Seville when it was published in some magazines.
So you're doing a tremendous number of various projects in Georgia. Can you talk a little bit about these and talk about the future of these and your future in general?
Georgia is at an interesting moment right now where it really transforms and reinvents itself. They're building the first highway. They're building all these new infrastructures. And for us, it's really interesting to see how the government and also private clients see architecture or want architecture in buildings or projects that are usually not connected to what we understand as architecture. We do rest stops along the new highway, which are partly cultural spaces for the local, you know, community to show artwork or to show local arts and crafts, as much as a shopping, you know, center and gas stations, with an architectural solution or proposal that is quite unique, and even the first people want to have their marriage there, you know, which is, I think, a great kind of proof that it raises the fascination of Georgian people. We did and finished last year the Sarpi border station, which is on the Black Sea coast between Georgia and Turkey. Again, a building that I don't know which other country really cares about how their border stations look like. This is kind of the eye-opening when you come to Georgia or leave Georgia. It's not a division between the two countries. It's actually a building that has terraces and meeting rooms that you can rent. So it's more of a place that unites rather than divides. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at you enter and how to exit or meet at this moment for countries. The airport was built in a very short time, like in 3 months. And it's very important and urgent somehow to also connect that part of Georgia to the rest of Georgia, to Tbilisi and Batumi, and also develop it economically into a tourist destination for its UNESCO sites and skiing.
It seems like you're shaping a country.
To work in Georgia is kind of like acupuncture. It's, you know, kind of very pointed interventions and contributions to an architectural landscape. And we are not the only ones, you know, bringing contemporary architecture to the country. But to see them happening in infrastructures and buildings that usually are not seen as architectural projects is really refreshing and quite new. Since then, we also now are developing projects in Russia. You know, we do projects in Asia. We have further projects in Spain. And it's important for us to work in other cultures because they also feed back to how we look at our culture ourselves. Euroboden, the client who developed the apartment building Johannesstrasse, is already talking to us about new projects. So it proves that it was a very fruitful and productive conversation how we developed the project together. He's a very precise and very kind of visionary developer, which I think is what we need. We need architects. We need a partner that is as curious as we are for fresh ideas in architecture.
That was Kimberly Bradley in the Berlin studio of Jürgen Meyerhaar. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Don't forget you can hear daily live updates from the Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan this week. Tune in to the second hour of The Globalist. That's 8 to 9 a.m. Central European time, where I'll be in the studios of Il Sole 24 Ore with a selection of studio guests and reports each morning. Section D will be back next week at the same time with a Salone special, bringing you all the fun from the fair and beyond, so be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Playing you out, here's another track by Sufjan Stevens. This is Come Hear the Illinois. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Oh, great white city, I've got the adequate committee. Where have your walls gone? I think about it now.